You're making enough noise to wake up the dead.
I don't have to wake him up. He's up. I saw a hand.
You saw a hand?
Uh-huh.
Where?
Right over there.
Let me see it.
Right over here.
Where is it?
I saw a hand there.
You don't know what you're talking about. You're all excited reading this legend. Now, listen. Listen, Wilbur. I know there's no such a person as Dracula. You know there's no such a person as Dracula.
But does Dracula know it?
All right. Let's go. Season 5, episode 10. Welcome, P4Peers. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Maddie.
All's well in your camp?
All's good. Very busy. Coming through to you today on a new microphone or a different microphone. Probably not as good quality, but we're going to make it through this.
Yeah, you have to put your fancy microphone. You've got gigs. You've got things to do. So you're on your little.
I'm doing a little revamp of my studio vis-a-vis some voiceover work I'm trying to get. And it's a little crazy in here. So I don't want to mess with the good mic because I got auditions and I'm frightened. So bear with me.
No, you should.
Yeah, well, trust me.
Yeah. Once the VO community gets a wind of you being back on the block, things are going to.
It's going to shake the foundations of all of it. The whole industry is going to know.
Speaking of making, shaking up the industry, I don't know if you got my text, Tony, but we cracked 10,000 listens as of this past episode last week. So it's kind of a little milestone for us. Congratulations.
I just got that text right before we signed on, and my mind is blown. I can't believe it. I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's a crazy number.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people do podcasts, you know, and I know there are podcasts out there that have, you know, millions and millions and hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands. But for us, for two guys doing it from our basements, basically, it's fun to hit that number 10,000. It's fun. So thank you, P4Peers. It means a lot.
It really does. Nice producing there, Maddie. It's really, you know, I'm just sitting here chatting. I don't really do any of the labor. So.
Well, it's truly an effort of love. I love doing it. I will tell you this. We're going to have a tough summer again, though.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's coming.
Why do you have to tell me now in the midst of all this good news? Why couldn't you wait until we were doing an episode where we're already fighting about something?
I think it's important to note, too, we would have hit 10,000 a long time ago, but I was gone virtually the whole summer. So we took weeks and weeks off. And it's going to happen again this summer, but we will get through it.
What I'd like to propose to you and to our listeners is that you and I, Maddie, do a little technical work to get the field recording capabilities just that much tighter. So if we can do a show from the road, it'll just be that much easier. He takes a long drink, thinks about it.
I like that in theory. The problem is on most of these adventures I'm on in the summer, I'm in places where to communicate with the outside world, you need to have a squirrel run a piece of string and tinfoil up to the top of the abandoned barn and hopefully get a signal of a CB trucker driving by.
I guess you squirrel by 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
You know,
with nail polish.
I ain't at the Ritz. Let's put it that way. I'm either at a place like that or I'm underwater, literally underwater or under a cave perhaps. But no, I get your point. We will do better this summer because now I'll be prepared. And we'll try to pump some stuff out. It's amazing we did what we did last summer. Every trip I took was last second, it seemed like.
It was crazy. Yeah, you had an insane schedule.
Yeah, so hopefully with, you know, kind of post-COVID world, I'll be able to have a little bit more notice on where I'm going this summer. But and it might be fun to be in different locations. And I can actually probably talk a little bit more freely of where I am and what I'm doing now that it's out beyond Oak Island. We're in the middle of the season. Two right now. We've got this week off, but March 1st is the next Beyond Oak Island, another treasure adventure. This one brought me to the U.S.-Mexico border, which was really exciting. And I made some beautiful friends for life down there on our border. Wonderful people, both American side and Mexican side, both people who were born and raised in El Paso and people who were born in Mexico and came to El Paso and made a living. It was just an awesome experience to be in that part of the country. I hadn't really been on the border before for any extended period of time. So, but more on that maybe next week. It's a cool episode. I think you'll dig it.
Okay. I can't wait.
All right. Let's get to what we're doing. This is Rated P for Paranormal. As you know, if you're new, welcome. If you're our 10,001 downloader, welcome to the show. We rate and review specifically paranormal films and television, films that deal with anything in the ethereal realm, from ghosts to UFOs to Bigfoot, cryptids, everything in between. We kind of watch movies because Tony's an expert cinephile. We're both in the business and we just love to talk about this stuff. So we've kind of narrowed our focus to review film and television that deal with this stuff instead of just being another paranormal podcast. We kind of slide in through the back door, if you will.
You had a sound effect in the edit when you say I'm a cinephile expert. Yes. There's a little wah, wah, like a crazy sound effect.
Jessica! Why would I do that to you?
Just because it's inappropriate to label me as such. Sir,
I disagree, but okay, I understand. But you know what? To remedy that, we have a new feature this week, thanks to our director friend Peter Stray, who is going to occasionally weigh in on whatever movie it is we cover in a new segment that we're going to call not rated P for paranormal, but rated Peter for paranormal, because Peter is going to drop a little knowledge.
Yes, I'm glad he's contributing. Of course, he knows more about the world of Attack the Block than we do, so I'm sure he has some pointers.
Hello, Tony and Matty. Peter Stray here. Attack the Block. I'm so glad you guys did this. This is definitely on my rated P for Peter Stray shelf as well. And it's just brilliant. It's a really tight 88 minutes. And it was a huge influence in Canaries, my own movie, which Tony edited. So I know this is all bias. But the main thing for me that's fascinating is I want to draw a parallel between Get Out from Jordan Peele and this movie, and maybe some other movies from around the world. And the reason is Joe Cornish, you guys won't know, but he was one half of a comedic duo in the Adam and Joe show, which was popular in the UK at the time. And Jordan Peele, obviously popular from one half of a comedic duo with Key and Peele. And I know there have been movies in Japan where people have been like light entertainers, comedians, and then they've suddenly like gone into directing horror movies. I don't know what is in the water or in the mindset of these people that this seems to be a trend around the world. Maybe it's they were all infected with alien spores. Another thing was that Tom Townend, the director of photography who shot this movie, got the job because he was talking to Joe Cornish about the exact date they changed the tungsten in New York City lights at night, which is why earlier New York City movies like The Warriors have a certain look and later movies don't have the same look. Was a lot of them use these New York City streetlights and they actually changed the lights somewhere around 1982, 1983. So there's a little extra tidbit for you. And Terry Notary, who was the main person in the suit with the alien creatures, was inspired by the Bakshi animation Ringwraiths from Lord of the Rings, if any of you have seen that. Anyway, so Terry Notary is famous for being sort of an animal and movement specialist, and he also did some stuff on Cabin in the Woods, which was another influence on my movie Canaries. He's worth a shout out because he was the lead alien in the suit, and he had a couple of trainees, but he was the guy. By the way, I really hope that you guys are going to make Pound Ridge 2 an extra pounding before too long. Bye.
Absolutely. We also have our top three segment that we end every episode with this season, which we're going to keep that ball rolling. It's great fun. It's always based on the movie that we're reviewing. Something we see in the movie strikes us as a top three potential. Tony, what's our top three this week?
Our top three is top open-handed slaps to the face.
That's fantastic. The top three open-handed slaps to the face in movie history. Of course, you'll understand why when I tell you, as you know, if you saw the art for this episode, when you downloaded it, this is Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. How could we not talk slaps?
King of slaps. Slap happy people they are. I mean, you know, Three Stooges may have beat them on the slaps, but or even Laurel Hardy may have. But when they lay down a slap, it's priceless.
It's good stuff. Well, let's get into it. Let's get into Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. It's an old classic. Thank you to Michael Robinson, a P4Peer donator. Means a lot to us. Thank you so much. If you'd like to donate, go to our website, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. You can leave us messages. You can donate. You can participate. Chime in on old episodes, movies that you disagree with, our reviews on, suggestions for movies, all that stuff. Just participate. We're also on social media at Rated Paranormal. Without any further ado, let's do Michael Robinson's viewer suggested Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Dracula can change himself at will into a vampire bat, flying about the countryside. Flying.
Normally, we try to avoid spoiler alerts when we do these films, in case you haven't seen them. But I think the fact that this movie was made in, what, Tony? 1948,
made in 47. Yeah, I think,
you know,
it's on you if you're worried about this being spoiled.
Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, 1948 horror comedy. You know, Tony, we were talking last week about how, you know, if not the first, certainly an early adopter of what's become a huge genre, and that is, you know, mixing what scares us with what makes us laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked into this a little bit. As I said, you know, I love horror. I love comedy. I didn't really know the history of the two. I knew the ones I loved, you know, but in looking through this, this movie is kind of the big first notable horror comedy mashup. There had been others, you know, like weirdly D.W. Griffith made a movie way back in the 20s. And he's not a guy that I love too terribly much, but he did make a film that apparently was a mashup of those two styles. But, you know, Abbott and Costello might have actually been there earlier with a movie called, if I can get my note, Hold That Ghost, which I think was before this. So there was some, they did some scary stuff. But this was the first time that they brought in the Universal, the classic Universal monsters to help them. And it's like the first time.
Yeah. And I think that's highlighted by the fact of some of the production problems they had in terms of like casting, for example. Like I always think of whoever it was that pitched Bela Lugosi, you know, we're going to do can you don the cape again, except it's going to be with Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, and we're going to make a farce of this whole thing. I imagine that was a tough pitch.
Like 25, 30 years later, too.
Yeah.
He
yeah,
only like, played Dracula twice.
I saw that, and this was the last time.
This was the second and last time he ever played Dracula. He played amazing vampires and creepy guys and ghouls and stuff, but he never actually played Dracula except for these two moments in history.
Incredible. And then didn't Frankenstein himself say no? And they had to get the Western star, Glenn Strange, to play Frankenstein in this movie.
Boris Karloff said no, thank you. He said no, not because he didn't want to play Frankenstein so much as what I heard is that he didn't want to make a joke out of it.
I think that highlights the fact that this is an early attempt at mixing, you know, humor with something scary.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think they understood what was going to happen. This was a giant hit. Movie really, I think, was a pretty big winner for them all.
Yeah.
Even though apparently Bud Abbott and Lou Costello were not fans of the script when they first got it. They weren't really that enthused. They didn't want to do the movie at first, apparently. But I guess they were won over at some point when they made enough money to make sequels to this.
It's interesting. And Michael Robinson, his voicemail got cut off when I if he's listening to this episode now, the fan who suggested this movie in the first place, he started to say something like, this movie means a lot to me, you know?
Yeah. He was going to tell us about its history with him.
Yeah. And I would, and specifically like what it meant to him. And I would love to hear more on that. If you have a chance, Michael, to leave us another message, it just got cut off. Your message just stopped for some reason. I'd love to hear why this meant so much to you. And I know it means a lot to a lot of people. They hold it in high esteem. So it's interesting. It had some of these backstories of difficulty getting it off the ground. And then, you know, Bud and Lou themselves not liking the script and all that. And then having to kind of like work their magic on set. It's pretty fascinating. It's an incredible time capsule to look at this movie. It really is.
The thing, my takeaway is how much times have changed and how nothing's changed.
Yeah.
I really like there's, you know, this is like an Adam Sandler movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, if you see an Adam Sandler movie, it's pretty basic. It's not very sophisticated, but it hits a sweet spot, you know, ridiculous physical comedy and kind of vaudevillian tropes. They still can make me laugh sometimes, much to my disappointment in myself.
Like, what am I doing? Yeah, totally, totally. There's a scene early on, and by the way, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello play baggage handlers in, I think it's like set in North Florida or something.
Yeah, it's in Miami or something.
Okay, yeah. And so they're baggage handlers, and a pair of crates show up. It's run by those crates are owned by a horrors museum owner, and
crazy person.
Crazy, but always in a rage, always mad. Mr. McDougal, he demands that they deliver these things personally so they can be inspected for insurance purposes, because Lou, of course, you know, makes a big mess of the crates and everything in a comedic scene. Dracula and Frankenstein are in the crates, and they've got this devious plot. So that's the basic setup, which you don't really need, although it's kind of funny.
All of it's just an excuse to get Lou and Bud creeping around a giant haunted mansion. That's really all of it is designed.
How can we get
that.
Them there? Yes. And there's a funny scene, and you know, one of my favorite scenes in the movie happens right at the beginning when they are doing the baggage handler thing. And Lou does a very like Three Stooges-esque curly move where he kind of like barks at the ladies. She's got like I don't know what it is. Is it like a little wrap?
She's got a stole around her neck or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's got a little Wolverine face
head.
Fur,
yeah.
And he does the like bark at it. But then he just like does this sachet glide. Do you remember what I'm talking about? He he skips out to the baggage, and it's just like this guy is just having his own movie in his own head. He's just going to take this thing over and just have a blast. And you know, it's like he breaks the fourth wall probably a half dozen times where he delivers a funny line and looks into the camera and looks at us. It's really, he was amazing.
It's you know, it's the look up shamelessness on Wikipedia, and this is a picture of him. You know, it really is. But does he to me, he sells it? Does he sell it do you buy what he's selling?
Well, here's the problem with it, and I got to admit this. You mentioned the Three Stooges, and I could not get over it. It was a block for me how much Curly, like I mentioned that one scene, at the little thing. Now, I don't know the history, whether he was doing before Curly, so he gets the credit. I don't know. I don't really care. All I know is that I've got a Stooges bias because I grew up just dying laughing at the Stooges. I love them to this day. And I just felt like one of my critiques would be, I don't think they did it as good as the Stooges. I got to say, I don't think the humor lands as good as the Stooges. So for me, I just couldn't. And I was trying to stop myself. I'm like, stop thinking of Curly, watch the movie for its own merits. But every move he does, or a lot of them, are right out of that playbook. And then later in the movie, when they are in those hallways, opening the doors and stuff and all that wacky stuff, like I laughed, but I didn't laugh as hard as when the Stooges did it. I know that was one of my takeaways. I felt like it was one note short.
This is kind of cool, because it's kind of like people talk about like Beatles, Stones, Kinks. So I think of those three, I'm not even gonna tell you where I land there. But I can,
I bet Kinks.
Cause you're right. You're right.
Ah, I knew it.
I kind of feel like Laurel and Hardy, Stooges, and Abbott and Costello are always vying for a similar thing. I was always a Laurel and Hardy person.
Yeah.
Like you were Stooges. I was completely in love with Laurel and Hardy. I still am. I like all of this stuff, to be honest. I really like ridiculous. I like ridiculous slapstick comedy, and I like to see smart people doing really stupid things. I think it's still great.
Agreed.
So
agreed.
Any version of it is good, but I kind of agree with you. Like I was as a kid more into Stooges, I guess, than this. But this movie was one of my babysitters. And I'm wondering if Michael Robinson, who called this in, also, maybe that's one of the reasons that he picked it, because it was a perennial. This movie was on a lot. Like we were talking last week about, you know, the non-network channels that you can see afternoon movies and horror movies and stuff for kids. This was on a lot. And I don't think I've seen it like all in its entirety since then, but I have a lot of warm feelings about it just because this movie kept me company. And the genius of having them confront not just Frankenstein, but three Universal horror movie characters in one. You know, if you were a Universal horror movie fan, that triple play would make you love this movie in a very deep way that maybe wouldn't hit you. I have a lot of affection for it, but I agree. The comedy doesn't, it's not as sharp to me or as irreverent or as perverse as Stooges stuff.
Yeah. One of the things I kept laughing at, because I was watching it with like the X-ray notes on Prime, reading trivia and stuff. And again, just seeing like Bela Lugosi do his serious, incredible acting, by the way, it was locked in when he really locks in, like look in my eyes and all that. Apparently, it's funny, on the set, they used a guy to kind of be like comic relief in between takes and stuff. And there was a story, Bela Lugosi's coming down the stairs in one of the scenes in this movie, and he's got his cape and he's about to deliver dialogue. And this actor that they used to kind of just break up the set and keep it light was mimicking him behind him. And the crew's all dying laughing, trying not to laugh. And then finally they can't contain it, and they all start laughing. And Bela Lugosi turns around and sees him and goes like, "We should not be messing around when we are doing a scene."
He gets upset and he walks off. Amazing. Amazing.
I couldn't focus on the movie, and because it's all I could think of is poor Bela Lugosi with these. I mean, it's, and then Glenn Strange, who plays Frankenstein, is like, you can see him smiling in three or four scenes, or like fighting a smile. In like three or four scenes, which just made it a delight.
Well, he's got a friendlier face than Boris Karloff. Yes. So just even when he's just kind of at rest, he looks like he's kind of a gimmicky. He looks a little bit more like Herman Munster than Karloff.
Absolutely. Huh. Yeah. Hilarious.
The thing I think that I find funny about it, or let me say this, what in defense of Lou Costello, he's more of an actor than the Stooges are. And he's one of the things I think that's really great about watching him work is that he actually connects the dots emotionally with this ridiculous stuff. He's always in character to a degree, never does anything outside of what his character would do. Whereas the Stooges was anarchy. There was no norm for any of them. They were all unpredictably insane.
I'm not sure they were even acting.
I don't think really at all. I think it was, they were aggressively hated each other and they just beat each other up.
Like Shemp, poor Shemp, who I think is one of the funniest characters ever on television in the history of the medium. Like Shemp, just when I was a kid, he always made me laugh at the hair flopping down and just, I just always felt like he like really kind of didn't want to be hit. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
When he's like got that frustrated look on his face, I think he's like really frustrated, but go ahead. Sorry.
They were also, you know, very physical. Whereas, you know, Abbott and Costello were more vocal, more about the repartee a little bit.
Yeah, the back and forth, the one-liner, the two-liner. Yeah, just back and forth. Yes, 100%.
And at their best, when they did the thing they did the best, they were incredible. I mean, even as hackneyed as Who's On First is, if you see the original.
Genius.
It's genius. It's just sublime. I mean, you can't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you, man. It's like, you wish that a director who had, I feel like the director in this case had worked with them before and was a little bit of a yes man to maybe them or just didn't have a lot of maybe ideas, because this shouldn't lag at ever. Like this kind of comedy you shouldn't be checking your watch. And there were a few points where I was just like, can we get through this swamp? It's like 20 minutes of just crawling around. And even though that was frustrating, though, here's what I'm going to say. I won't go off on a tangent. That part of it, though, to a degree, is what makes it a really interesting horror comedy. Hmm. Because when it's a horror movie, it's a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a comedy, it's a comedy. Instead of making, you know, all the horror stuff kind of jokey, some of it is. But when they're in danger, for instance, and they're being, you know, tracked by the monster through the woods, or they're trying to, you know, find the wolfman in the swamps of Miami, which is hysterical.
Hilarious.
They're kind of playing it for like a scary movie for back then.
Yeah.
And I think if you were an audience back then, that wouldn't be quite as tedious as it is now, because it would be like, you know, full of fresher.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a shot. The opening shot is like London. Lon Chaney Jr.'s in London.
Yes.
And that shot is stunning. And there's a close up of his eyes through the shades, and it's actually frightening. It's like, wow, it's almost Hitchcockian. You know, it's like really.
Yeah.
I wish there had been more of that juxtaposition between that and the humor. You're right. I agree with everything you're saying. When it's scary, it's scary. But it was never at that level as the very opening scene.
No. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I don't really think it achieved scary, but I think what they were going for was scary. Right.
It takes those moments seriously.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bela Lugosi's not delivering silly dialogue as Dracula. He's delivering his dialogue as Dracula dialogue straight up, looking in my eyes. And you're right.
And for audiences then, you know, it was a treat to see him come back and play a part that probably everybody who saw this movie as a kid, their grandparents told them, when I was young, I saw Dracula and it scared the hell out of me. It was the scariest thing ever.
Right.
And so, you know, the reputation was still kind of alive, and it was still kind of, you know, it was easier to buy into it as a scary movie, you know, a little bit.
You mentioned it being your babysitter. I saw a funny fact too. Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead said this was the movie that changed his life. Like, you know, he was too young when he saw it as a little kid, and was so frightened by it. Of course, didn't get any of the comedy. He was a little, probably 5-year-old or whatever he was. And he said that it helped him. The monsters, you know, the three monsters and just the whole art of it kind of, he feels partly put him in the direction of the arts, you know. It had a huge effect on him. Yeah, it's kind of just a funny little footnote that Jerry Garcia, we wouldn't have the Grateful Dead maybe if it wasn't this movie, which is funny.
That is really strange. The connection there is insane.
Yeah.
And I can relate to that. As I've stressed here before, you know, I loved the RKO and Universal horror movies growing up. So I saw this, I'd already seen all the, you know,
right,
Dracula movies and Frankenstein, werewolf, mummy movies, all of them by the time I saw this. So even as a little kid, I was ready and I knew what the joke was, and it didn't really scare me. None of these movies scared me. I just thought they were great. You know?
Right.
What they do get right is some of the art direction, and they spent some money on this. You know, that some of the sets are really cool. The stuff looks a little bit more, you know, paid attention to than some of the, you know, it's not a B movie. It's more of an A movie, because they were huge stars, you know. Yeah. That's a difference between Stooges and them too, because the Stooges are huge stars, but I don't think they were at the level of Abbott and Costello. They were, I think Abbott and Costello were among like the top 10 stars of their day.
Incredible.
So they may have had to soft pedal some of this too for the audiences, because it was such a wide audience that they may have had to temper some of the violence or the insanity for that. Who knows?
Right. Shout out to Jane Randolph, Lenore Aubert. One's an insurance investigator. Jane Randolph, I believe, plays the insurance investigator, and Lenore is in on the evil plan. And they're awesome. And there's a scene when they kind of battle wits with each other, and it becomes like a spy scene, becomes like a spy movie a little bit between them, you know, who knows what. And she knows that Jane is an insurance investigator. And I was like, I'd like another couple scenes of them trying to match wits. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, me too. The backstory with Dracula conniving and trying to get what he wanted, I'm like, don't you have superpowers as Dracula? Like, why are you relying on, like, you know, telegrams and things, like weird antiquated
like books,
science to get you through this. But that's kind of part of its charm, you know. It's an interesting mashup that way, because it's got this weird like noir angle with these horror characters behaving more like gangsters in a 30s, you know, in a 30s melodrama.
Yeah, it's so funny. Another thing that stood out was Lon Chaney Jr.
What an
actor he was, like,
right?
He the way he delivers dialogue and that character is such a sad character when you think about it. And you know, before this movie, of course, the whole story of how he became the werewolf and suffering like that with that affliction, and just the way he was, the perfect cast, whoever cast him in that role did a hell of a job, because just him delivering dialogue, he's just so, he conveys like brokenhearted so well.
Yeah, know? He really feels like a broken person when he delivers all this stuff. And
he does.
You're right about that character being truly tragic. Like it's, you know, I mean, in a long history of these creatures actually all being pretty tragic. Frankenstein's a tragic character. Oh. I mean, the monster in that is, and
yeah,
you know, the who else is kind of tragic? Maybe that's as far as the tragedy goes for these monsters. But like the werewolf didn't ask for this.
Right.
You get bitten in the middle of the night and then all of a sudden you're in a lot of trouble.
He's begging to be locked in places because he knows what he's capable of. And
he's always really sweaty and his hair is always like flopping down. And he gets frustrated with people that aren't listening to him. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just thought of another actor that could have played the Wolfman. Shemp. Based on that description.
You should have seen his screen test.
Do you know how Shemp died, by the way?
What? How or when? I don't know what you just said. No, I don't.
Do you know how Shemp died? He was in a cab. He loved boxing. In real life. So he went to a big boxing match. And as the legend goes, he lit a cigar in the back of the cab with his three best friends. And he's like, I got a joke for you. And he told the joke, hit the punchline. They all laughed and he went boom and slumped over dead in the cab.
Are you serious?
Yep. Told the joke and died.
Oh my God. I never heard that story.
Yeah. Like right in Hollywood, right outside of Hollywood.
Oh my God. That's really amazing.
Yeah. So,
wow. Yeah. I mean, That's tragic, but not entirely without some humor.
It's a way for, you know,
what a way to go if you're him.
You're a comedian. Yeah.
What a way to go. God.
It's like a drummer dying in his drums.
If he didn't get that punchline out, he'd be a ghost haunting Hollywood right now, trying to get that punchline across.
You'd like open a door. Like, it was the waiter. Great stuff. Yeah, so he stood out to me, Lon Chaney Jr., of just like, what an actor, what an interesting actor.
Yeah, yeah. Simple, like really simple, but
yeah,
but and kind of humble, but but really truthful. You know, I mean, I've always been curious about his life, you know, having had a dad who was as famous as his dad was, you know. Mm. I mean, Lon Chaney was one of the most famous actors in Hollywood when he was growing up, when Lon Chaney Jr. was growing up. And I wonder if he got some of this work because his dad made him be like a model for makeup characters and that he was used to it. Like, I always wondered, like, cause he really only succeeded as, you know, as this character. And then a lot of B movies after this and Roger Corman-esque stuff like Spider Baby. I don't know if you ever saw Spider Baby, but
no.
Like things got a little scary in the 60s and the drinking really started taking over a lot of these guys.
Yeah. Yeah. They all died young in quotes, you know, like
they died young and in trouble. A lot of them.
Yeah. Lou Costello died. I think he was like 53 or something. I saw he was in the 50s. Yeah. Awful.
Apparently the two of them were well-liked, were good, like nice people. What I've heard. I don't know whether that matters, but it's nice to hear.
Well, it is nice to hear because it's, you know, you know, at the end of the day, it's a lighthearted comedy. So if you know these guys are like monsters behind the scenes, it's hard to, you know, really get into it. And there's a spirit, I think, that, you know, it's a deeper point, but I do think the camera kind of picks up someone's DNA to some extent, you know, and movies have spirit. You and I have talked about that before. Movies, you know, have a feel, and sometimes you sense when it's not a great spirit, you know, they're out to do something kind of creepy or bad. And like this movie just screams just good times.
I don't know. I'll argue that point with you about how visible that spirit could be, because I think you could see like shots of the Rat Pack hanging out and be like, hey, those guys look like they're fun. I think you might want to leave the room.
That's true. I guess in some cases you can pick it up, in others you can't. But yeah, Lou Costello, like, I think, yeah, let's see, he died, 1906 to 1959. Okay, so yeah, he was only...
Wow, so he died not long after this movie.
Yeah, my God, that's young. He looks a lot older than that. But these guys all drank, like, and drank and smoked, like, you know.
Seems like it. And they lived a pretty hard life on the vaudeville circuit before they became movie stars, all of them. You know, they worked, like... They worked like demons traveling this country at every
yeah.
juke joint vaudeville show. Right. How, you know, they work their craft, and they, you know, that's how they met. Bud Abbott and Lou Costello met on the vaudeville circuit. And this was after Lou went to Hollywood to try to become famous, and they rejected him. He didn't make it. And they said, go learn your stuff. And they kicked him back out to like Kansas City. He didn't even have enough money to get back east. So he stayed in Kansas City, got jobs as a comic, and worked his stuff for years, you know?
Yeah. It's incredible. Like I, that, Who's On First, for example, came from their vaudeville act.
Yeah.
They had all that worked out for years.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Bud Abbott, his voice sounds like a PSA for not smoking too much.
God. Is there, has there been a more disgruntled man in the world? He's never happy. It's just constantly angry about everything.
It's perfect. It's perfect because Lou's constantly, you know, bopping around like there's not a care in the world. It's like you and me.
It is. It is. Straighten up.
Do you have, yeah, totally, always. Do you have a favorite line between, there's so many quick lines of funny dialogue in here. Did one stand out to you that just...
Not the lines so much. It's really not the lines or the dialogue that stood out to me, but just like moments of them looking, like the way they would interact with each other, just the silent things that they would do,
yeah.
You know, the pauses, the ability to like know exactly how long to pause with each other. Like the familiarity that they have together as performers is just like the ease of it is, it's just a pleasure. So the script didn't knock me out. There wasn't anything I like really noticed, except I do literally love lines like, what's the matter with you? Get going. Like those lines I love whenever Abbott is like, you know, smacks him and then says like, pull yourself together.
Straighten
like stuff
up.
Like it's just every time it makes me laugh.
Come on, chick. Be just like you used to be.
God, go away with it.
I'll get my hat and coat. I'll be right with you.
All right. Put your hands down. I'll let the air out of you in a minute if you don't give me a hand. Understand it?
There's a moment, there's a running gag where the two women are pretending to be in love with Lou Costello to get what they want. Bud Abbott's going crazy because he's like looking at Lou Costello.
Can't
like,
understand.
So there's a quick line where I burst out laughing. I'm always a sucker for a good vaudeville line like this, well-timed and well-delivered. The girl says something to Lou Costello, one of the girls, and he goes, how can you look at me in the face and say that? And Bud Abbott goes, how can you look at him in the face?
Yeah.
Like
my feeling is that was an ad lib. Like my feeling is there was, that was, that came up with that on the set.
And then he pulls him over to the light. He's like, what are you doing? He's like, I just want to see you in the light. Like,
yeah.
What am I missing here? Why are these women attracted to you? It's just, that was
that
very funny.
That really truly was funny. Sidebar, you know, they had initially wanted to do this as a Broadway show.
No kidding.
Years before. Yeah, they had the idea. They liked the, it wasn't that they didn't like the idea. They didn't like the script that they were handed by the studio, but they actually came up with the idea, or maybe Lou did, that they wanted to do a horror musical vaudeville like show on Broadway with the two of them, which I wish had happened now. Like, because I think what would have happened if they'd done that, they would have done that show. They would have perfected it. Just like the Marx Brothers perfected all their movies on the road before they shot them. And then they would have had the tightest movie ever when they went to make it.
Got it.
These gags hadn't been tried out, and you can kind of see that they're making stuff up just on the fly a little bit. Like, you know, there's long sections where there's just like, okay, I'll run out of this room and you run out of this room and I'll go boo and you go wow and I'll leave. Like really a little simplistic, but that's a great line of dialogue. I forgot that one.
Yeah, you're looking at the face. What do you know about, if anything? I just know I've heard that they didn't get along. Bud and Lou, like kind of off in real life or towards the end, certainly. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't. I really don't. It doesn't look like they get along. I mean, I'd certainly believe that they just didn't get along. And I don't know if that's just because they convincingly do their act or if they let their real feelings kind of come out in the work. I don't know.
Right.
Did you read about that?
A little bit. So there was one article that says that they didn't, you know, I think they, like many partnerships, they probably started off close. And by the end, they weren't too close. And there's one thing here I found that says, according to reports, Abbott and Costello harbored ill will toward each other for years, beginning in 45. when Abbott reportedly hired a maid who had previously worked for Costello. The report states that Costello then took their feud to the press, kickstarting many years of infighting and bad feelings. Errol Flynn claimed in 1957 he played a porno film in front of the comedy duo and their families as a practical joke. According to that report, Abbott and Costello blamed each other, each one blaming the other, for the inappropriate film in front of the families, not knowing that Flynn himself was behind the prank. Flynn later claimed that the mix-up was the ultimate cause for their breakup that same year. Wow. So, yeah, that's kind of a weird story.
That's a weird story.
Yeah.
Yeah, good old Errol Flynn. Yeah.
Hey, everyone, look at that. Want to see a movie? Thanks, Errol.
Thanks, Errol. Don't invite him anywhere. God.
Here's Pound Ridge. So, yeah, that's kind of sad, but I don't know how much of that is true.
Too bad. That's sad. I mean, you know, Laurel and Hardy weren't best of friends, I don't think. You know, they had a professional relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's always so strange when you hear that. I mean, I've been in, you know, we've been in the business forever, and isn't there a part of you that just every time you hear that, you just kind of cry a little bit inside? Yeah, you're just totally. Like, ah. It's so because bad because you feel like if you can't have fun doing this stuff, when can people have fun?
Any final thoughts on Abbott and Costello Meet the Frankenstein, which is, by the way, a misnomer because they meet so many other monsters.
They meet everybody. They meet everybody, including a lady vampire.
That's right.
You know, she's very scary. She's actually legitimately probably the scariest character in it.
And we should say Vincent Price makes a VO cameo at the end.
It's a voiceover cameo, yeah.
And is that Lon Chaney, like you mentioned, Lon Chaney's dad? Does he make an appearance in this movie? Does he pop up?
No, he was okay. Chaney was senior, was dead before this
got it.
Happened. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Okay. There was like a monster in the background. I wonder if that was him with the makeup, but
yeah, there were things. I mean, like, look, notable little things I loved. I mean, I kind of smiled right away with the titles because that bone font that they made for fantastic. The titles is fantastic. I just so love that.
Saturday morning cartoons, you know?
Yeah, it was great. I love the Max Fleischer influence in general on it. Like, you could see it. That was a very Max Fleischer cartoon kind of element. And so it was the rotoscoping of Dracula appearing and disappearing. The effect of having him turn into a bat, you know, and fly away. The bat is like a real rubber bat. And then it becomes Bela Lugosi. In that transition, it turns into a cartoon, a rotoscoped cartoon.
I love that. I actually love that.
I do too. I thought it was really cool.
I think I saw in one of the, I hope I'm not making this up, but one of the facts that flashed by as I was watching the notes with the movie was that the guy who did that did Woody Woodpecker cartoons also.
I believe so. I mean,
that's kind of a cool little fact too.
Yeah.
If that's true.
That technique, that rotoscoping technique had been around since like 1917 or 1920 or something, but it had been used in a lot of early silent movies and stuff, but you know, it was on its way out here, but it still was effective. That's the cool thing about black and white is that it like the effects, actually you can hide all the stuff that doesn't really work and it still kind of looks cool.
You'd have to like recolor that stuff. Yeah. It would be weird.
I love Lou Costello being afraid. I could watch Lou Costello be afraid for an hour. So that's a lot of pleasure for me. He's left alone a lot.
Yes.
To kind of like wait for people in creepy places, and he gets scared and we stay with him while he's like getting more increasingly nervous.
Yeah.
I don't know. He kills me with that increasingly nervous thing he does.
He laps into like where his dialogue just becomes like,
yeah. Which, you know, you in fact are known for also.
That's how I laugh. Dom DeLuise grabbed a little bit of that.
Yes, he did. 70s. Totally did.
And to talk about his level of commitment, another little factoid that I think is great that I saw was there's a scene where Frankenstein punches through a door. They're standing on either side. And the way it was blocked was the fist is supposed to come in between their face and Lou and was supposed to go like, you know, do his whole thing. Well, on purpose, he stepped in front of the panel so he gets hit in the face. He did it on purpose because he knew it'd be funny. I'm like, man, that's great. And you watch it, you see him kind of like, oh, you know, like
that is great.
And I think it's just the greatest thing ever. Like old time commitment, man. Let's do this. Like,
I mean, you know, Jackass 4 just came out. So let's just give a little praise to the people that put themselves in physical jeopardy just to give us a chuckle.
There you go.
It's a special breed. It's fantastic. I want to give a shout out to whoever was the stunt person who got thrown through that glass window.
You ain't kidding.
And there's the lady vampire. Comes to a demise because the wolf, is it the wolfman or Frankenstein?
Who Who throws?
One of them. I think it's the Frankenstein, probably big enough to throw her.
Yeah.
Picks her up and throws her out of a tall, very tall window. So he has to launch her kind of like four feet up into the air and then through this plate glass window.
Yeah.
And the stunt person didn't really make it. And it looked incredibly painful.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an expensive window to rebuild. So let's just keep rolling.
I was going
to
ask you a question, too. Do you think that The Thing, the 1950s Thing, a movie we reviewed right here on this podcast, do you think it was influenced by that Frankenstein walking into the fire scene? Because that's what came to my mind. Or was The Thing after? Was that in the 50s?
It was after the 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder if the thing, do you think The Thing was influenced by this movie? Because all I could think of, the scene I'm particularly talking about, is Frankenstein walks into fire, which is odd because in the Frankenstein movie, he was like, fire, bad, scary. He slowly walks into this fire and he ignites, and then it becomes like a dummy. But all I could think of was that scene in The Thing when the alien walks and gets illuminated.
I thought of it too, and you're right. I didn't really realize how this was quite a bit before. I think they really based that Thing monster on Frankenstein in general.
In general, the way it walks. So you think the guys who made The Thing, right? They were probably what, 9, 10 years old when they saw this movie, right?
Yeah, the special effects team was probably the kids. Yeah.
So it's like stuck in their subconscious or their
totally. I love that.
Conscious, maybe.
I love that. That's totally true. Huh. Yeah. And this was a big hit. So everybody saw it.
Right.
I love the device at the end of when they are fighting Frankenstein. They're running all through this haunted castle, which they have in Florida, like, apparently.
Yeah, there's all kinds of castles that you take a boat to.
With moats and dungeons and, Phantom of the Opera stuff.
It's called Lake Buena Vista. It's Disney World.
Yes. Maybe they were... Was Disney World there yet?
No, Disneyland didn't even open until, like...
I mean, Disneyland?
60. Disneyland in L.A. was 60s.
So weird how this actually kind of presaged some of that. Uh-huh. That's strange. Because the impresario, the horror impresario, I thought was a riff on Disney, but no.
Yeah. And the castle, I just made that as a joke, but it's kind of true. It's like,
interesting. Yeah. Cause I wonder if they were, the only thought I have is that maybe they were riffing on Citizen Kane. Cause that was like Florida, that mansion, but I don't think Citizen Kane was a big enough hit at that time to warrant them referencing it.
Interesting.
That's weird.
That is weird.
Love the monster fighting. Like, okay, it's just craziness. They're just running all around like children. They're literally like kids at recess.
It's so true.
And they're Abbott and Costello are trying to fight with Frankenstein and avoid him and run around. And then the wolfman is fighting Dracula.
Yeah.
And so that's always happening in the background.
Yes.
So no matter where they are, there's always like fighting. And in the background, you'll see Dracula and the wolfman like charge across the back of the set fighting.
All hell's broken loose.
Fantastic.
That's the other okay, so there are two big laughs I had. The line that made me laugh was that one I said earlier, but then another time was anytime Lon Chaney Jr. was chasing Bela. Bela Lugosi's like this really classy, was he Hungarian or something?
Yeah.
Like, really dignified actor.
Very dignified heroin junkie.
He has to do like the Jimmy Juke, like trying to stay on Lon Chaney's way. Lon Chaney's like this kind of big hulking guy.
Yeah, and they're all wearing all this crazy capes and costumes and makeup. I'm sure, I'm really sad that there isn't a blooper reel for this movie. That would have been the best ever.
Well, so it's funny. I mentioned Frankenstein smiling. There's an actual scene that they reference in those x-ray notes on Amazon where Lou Costello sits on Frankenstein's lap and it says, you can see him smiling because you didn't see the outtakes because every time he sat in his lap, he did a different reaction. He improvised a different reaction. The take we see in the film is like the fourth time he had done it. And you can see Frankenstein just can't not smile because he's just been cracked up by Lou Costello for, an hour. Fantastic.
I have a feeling hanging out on the set would have been funnier than the actual movie.
I agree.
And I want to see a movie about this guy who runs around making everybody laugh, because that was not just for this movie. That was actually a thing that they did in Hollywood from the 30s on, where they had a guy who wasn't in the movie. He was just hired to be
like a court jester,
a court jester, and loosen everybody up because of all the time it took between the gags. you know, they had, they just would deflate, and it would like, they'd wait for a camera setup and then try to do the gag. So they had to keep their laughter up, you know? And so there was a literal person hired to just goof off on the set on a lot of films.
Okay. I would like to nominate myself for Ewan Michaels' next movie. I will be the guy who goofs off on set all day.
There is nobody better for that job than you. That is absolutely a perfect. That's perfect.
I want a lot of money.
The more money you get, the more violent you become too.
Definitely. Tony, in the end, this time capsule, one of the early adopters of trying to mix horror and comedy. We've got big stars in this. We've got three big time monsters in this. We got Abbott and Costello. But is that enough to give this a rated P for paranormal, or are we giving it a P for pass?
Because I feel that this is gonna be a very small division on the shelf, you know, comedy, horror, comedy, supernatural. It's not something we've done a lot of, you know. Done my boy. This is maybe our fourth or third or fourth one in 50 episodes.
About
so
that, yeah.
I also have enough affection for it. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I can't, I have to give it a P for paranormal just because I owe this movie many, many Sundays of love as a child, and I can't turn my back on it.
Well,
and it was true to the, as true to the horror myths that could be under the circumstances. They didn't make a joke out of Dracula. They didn't make a joke out of how Frankenstein gets reanimated. In fact, they did a cool thing with Dracula's ring that electrifies his neck.
Oh,
and that
yeah.
was awesome.
I love that.
And they legitimately gave you a good wolfman who was tragic. And so I'm going to give it a P for paranormal.
I don't want to make you or Michael Robinson mad at me, but we're going to split on this. I agree with everything you said. I laughed at times. I thought it was really fun. I'm glad I watched it, but in the end, just not strong enough for me to, it's going to get
you
for pass for me. I know I want to, you know, part of me wants to keep it just for the historical value alone, but I feel like there's maybe another early movie we might stumble upon that I would want to replace it with that maybe didn't get the fanfare. As you say about the Beatles, Abbott and Costello, they're fine. They don't need my help.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're going to split
actually, they do, because no one's talking about them except for us right now. So you're wrong. No one made an 8-hour documentary about their work 2 minutes ago. So,
well, they haven't quite been dead for 50 years yet. But so we're going to split on this. Do you want to grab it on your part of the shelf as one of your keepers, Tony? You're getting close, though, to when you're going to have to kick something off. So,
okay.
We'll keep
maybe you're getting close too. You weren't looking at your bin. I don't know. Maybe I can be admonish you publicly.
Don't worry about me. You clean up your side. You take care of your side of the shelf. Don't they teach you that?
You asked me a simple question. I gave you a simple answer. P for paranormal.
All right. It's pass for me. Sorry, Michael. Sorry, Tony. Let's do our top three. Here's something we can agree on. The top three slap moments in film history as inspired by the great Abbott and Costello, who did a hell of a slap themselves. Tony, would you like me to start, or would you like you to start this week?
Why don't you give a start?
Okie dokie. Number three, I'm going with a comedy. This is one of my favorite movies. I think an underrated Christmas movie. It doesn't come up as some of the other Christmas movies do every year. But Scrooged, the great Carol Kane, who plays like a fairy ghost. You know, this I could be wrong about. I want to say she's Christmas present. I believe she's like the Christmas present fairy. There's a scene where she keeps slapping Frank, Bill Murray. And just like, she's like, come on, Frank. And she like slow man slaps him across the face. She's like, oh. And then it devolves to the point where she literally whacks him with a toaster. She just suddenly has a toaster for no reason. Like, fling, and just like whacks him in the face and knocks him unconscious. It's such a great scene. I think about it every time I think of a slap in a film. The great Carol Kane, who doesn't get a lot of credit either.
Oh, she's yeah.
Fantastic. So that's my number three.
So funny. Okay. Excellent. My number three is going to be a tie.
Okay.
Between Chinatown.
Oh.
and a movie called Point Blank.
Oh, what? You're putting Point Blank on one of our lists? That's shocking to me.
Why?
Oh, I was thinking of Point Break.
That's coming later.
I am an FBI agent. I
was like, that what? Is coming later. Okay. Don't trash that movie in front of me, please. Don't. Oh, come on, man.
All right.
Go oh, on. Boy. Oh, boy. All right. So it was go really ahead, hard to pick. I mean, these are pretty much two of the most famous slaps in movie history.
So the Jack Nicholson one, I definitely know that is some serious slapping.
Yeah. I mean, I think I pulled some stuff for you so you can give it here. So this is the slapping from Chinatown.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
Now, was there anything in the film history about that? Like, you know, how they did that? Did she really want him to slap or anything like that? Like,
I don't think she really wanted him to. But well, I think
you know
what
I
happened.
Mean. Like, he really slapped her, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does clearly slap her several times. I'm sure they agreed upon it. A lot of actors do that because it's very hard to, it's very hard, you know, in a drama where you're trying to be very realistic. It's truly almost impossible to sell that without, unfortunately, kind of like, going for it, so
having it or it looks really fake
when you see it, guaranteed the actors have agreed to kind of go there, but sometimes I think some actors take it a little farther than the agreed anyway. Chinatown, very famous. But it's tied with probably the granddaddy of all slapping scenes. I can't imagine more, and it's the granddaddy because there's just the most slapping. This is from the amazing Point Blank, starring Lee Marvin and Angie Dickinson. Give a listen. Have a listen to this.
Forget it.
You forget it!
She slaps the shit out of him.
And if anyone could take it, it'd be Lee Marvin.
And the great story behind it is that was 100% real emotion behind that slapping. She hated Lee Marvin.
Wow. I
so love that. Much that John Borman, the director, was like, just have at it. He can take it.
Oh my
God. She was super pissed at him actually in that moat, like during that day of shooting and he just stands there and just takes the most slapping, punching, beating you can imagine. As you could hear, it goes on forever.
I love it. Now I'm going to watch that movie tonight just because I want to see that. That's so great. That's one of those movies I know of. I love Lee Marvin, but I just never saw it. Number two, I had to do it. You know I can't do a list without some form.
I didn't know Stallone slapped anybody. I thought it was only closed fists.
Well, here's why you're not going to be mad at this choice. Listen to this performance.
I see.
Now you see nothing. Creed would have caved in the whole side of your face. Now forget it, kid. You got the heart, but you ain't got the tools no more. Now forget it.
Is that right?
That is right.
Yeah? Well, maybe it's you who ain't got it no more, you know that?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, that's it. Now look, you didn't even see that coming, did you? No. Well, that was from a broken down pug like me. What do you think the champ would do to you?
Oh, hurt me bad.
No, he'd hurt you permanent. Permanent.
Burgess Meredith in that hallway, you know, I've said it once, I'll say it again, Tony, if Sly Stallone had only made Rocky One, I mean, it's just a great 70s filmmaking moment. Burgess Meredith is at the top of his game. That scene gives me the chills for life. I just love it so much. That's a great slap. It's a great slap.
I'm going to slap you the next time you bring this movie up. Okay.
I wouldn't see it coming.
Okay, all right, that's look, it's legit, it's legit. A real thing. It's great.
It's a great slap, and you know Stallone's reaction's great too. He's so shocked, so hurt, you know, emotionally, that he knows Mickey's right. He couldn't see it coming. It's just a great moment. It's lit awesome. It's in this crappy hallway. It's fantastic. Great 70s movie.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Awesome.
Great slap.
Godfather is my number two. There's a scene in Godfather where Marlon Brando slaps a dude. He's just come into his office and he's crying because he's not a big movie star. And he's sad because his life is sad and he's not famous enough. And he's literally like weeping in front of Marlon Brando. And Marlon Brando reacts in a most surprising way. Have a listen.
Godfather, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do.
You can act like a man. What's the matter with you? Is this how you turn down a Hollywood Pinocchio that cries like a woman? What can I do? What can I do?
I mean, that is the most shaming, emasculating moment I've ever seen on camera. Having Marlon Brando scream at you just to be a man, shape up. Oh, it feels personal. I feel like he was actually talking to that actor.
Well, I saw a picture the other day. It's so funny you said that. It was of a paparazzi photographer, and he's trailing Marlon Brando, like 1977 Marlon Brando. And he's wearing like a sweater like this, and he's kind of like jacked in like a Nehru collar, like weird Brando. And he started getting weird with the long gray hair. And he's got a big medallion on. And the photographer behind him is wearing literally a 1970s football helmet, like an NFL football helmet with a face bar. And it said, "This is photographer Joe Smith. He took to wearing a helmet when he followed Brando because Brando had turned on him and punched him one time, breaking his jaw, and he needed dental surgery. He knocked like four of his teeth." So there's this picture of this real paparazzi guy wearing a freaking NFL helmet.
Wow. So I mean, look, that's, you know, that's what you get. You follow Brando around. I'm sorry. He doesn't hear a lawsuit. He doesn't care about your lawsuit. Wow. That's some stone.
Google
wow.
that photo. It's one of the funniest. I literally thought to myself, I want that as a print. I want that as like a, in my office, like a big, huge picture of that.
It's great revenge too, because it ensures that in every shot of Brando from then on, there's going to be the shot of a guy wearing a football helmet lurking around behind him. So it backfired on Brando terribly. Who's that guy with the helmet? Just don't worry about it. Why is he in every picture of you? Just stop.
And you know, guys like Sean Penn and stuff, like, God, why couldn't I have been around then?
Right, where's my guys? Yeah. Where's my helmet guy?
Yeah. All right, Tony, my number one open hand slap moment in film history. This one you're going to love. And if it's not your number one, I bet you it's in your honorable mentions. It's from one of our mutual favorite movies of all time. And what's beautiful about this is you get three guys slapped in one motion. Check this out.
Oh, you sure are a crazy son of a bitch. Yeah.
You think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
Are you calling me crazy? You think I'm crazy? Yeah. Yeah, you want to see crazy? I'll tell you.
Now, that's a real badge. I'm a real cop, and this is a real fucking gun.
Oh, yes.
So that's the drug deal scene in Lethal Weapon, of course, Mel Gibson with a triple, a nice callback accidentally to the Three Stooges, which came up today in this episode.
For real. Yeah, that's great. That was a smart move on your part. I didn't think of it. I wish I had. It is one of the great slaps of all time.
Fantastic.
Well, that was a great choice. All right. Well, my number one, let's get this over with quickly and fast and efficiently. The great 1950s noir extravaganza, Kiss Me Deadly. Ralph Meeker plays Mike Hammer in this movie, and this to me is the final word on the noir detective. He is the most brutal, uncompromising bastard you've ever seen in a movie. He's just a terrible man, violent, fascist, brutal, uncaring, wants what he wants, doesn't care about you at all. And this is typified by a great moment where he's had it. He's been kidnapped. He's been roughed up, and he's just had it. So he goes to a sports club to try to get the key to get this locker where he needs something in it. And he goes up to this little twerpy, fussy little guy behind the desk who's like really officious and snobby about the health club. And this is what happens.
Are you a member, sir?
No, just tell me about the key.
Pardon me, sir, if you're not a member. My dear sir. Now tell me about the key.
It's jaw-droppingly hysterical and violent, and it's exactly what you'd want to do to that this guy. Dude.
Do you know, I only knew about that because you reviewed it in your Arkin Brothers Talk Movies.
We did talk about that movie, yeah.
I literally looked that scene up, or you might have played it on the podcast. I don't remember. But, God, that made me burst out laughing. He kind of manhandles people throughout the movie, doesn't he?
Throughout the movie. Yeah, he just, yeah. When he's had enough, he just, like, pushes people and slaps them around. And, like, it's just fantastic.
Awesome.
That's my number one.
Great choices and great recommendations, too. Some deeper cuts there, per usual. I appreciate that because then go find things I haven't seen before. Honorable mentions for me. This was almost my number one. I guess I should have put it as number three. But the airplane scene, when they slap the hysterical women and then it becomes a line of people.
Like, that's classically great.
There's a great slap in Napoleon Dynamite when Napoleon Dynamite slaps his brother and he's like, geez, very funny. Kurt Russell slapping Billy Bob Thornton in that Western. I forget which one it was. The Wyatt Earp movie, I guess. He's like, throw down, boy. And he slaps him. Very humiliating. And finally, one of the funniest ones to me is Friday the 13th. The mom, like Jason's mom, like when she's admitting that she did it, there's like this chase scene in the room between her and the girl. And she just like gets on top of her and just open hand slaps her like four times in the face. And for some reason, it's just the funny, because she's like a 70-year-old actress, you know, it's just so the way it's staged. It's not supposed to be funny, but it's super funny.
Well, that's great. Honorable mention to all of Laurel and Hardy, all of it. And then to the great Monty Python, because the fish slapping dance isn't open-handed, but it is funnier than anything I've ever seen.
Yes, right.
You're getting slapped in the face by a salmon.
Oh, my God. Oh, I just thought of a new one because you just mentioned animals in Monty Python. Night at the Museum, Ben Stiller and the monkey. There's Ben Stiller and a little like rhesus monkey are just like, they have a slap off and it goes on forever. Like,
I vaguely remember that.
The monkey slaps Ben Stiller and he slaps him back and they just keep slapping each other. It's really funny. Yeah.
As we were saying earlier, it'd be so great to just be able to, you know, have a group of friends where you could just, as a joke, smack them, but you can't do that anymore. It's disrespectful and the people think it's assaultive.
We're in a new world, Tony. The old ways are done. Well, what did we miss? If we forgot a great slap in movie history, let us know. If we were wrong, if one of us was wrong about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, let us know that. If you have a recommendation for a movie, you can let us know that, or anything on your mind, let us know. Tony, this was a lot of fun. We have to come back next week with a new movie. We did an old American classic. How about something new? What's our film next week?
Okay, next week we're going to dive into a movie called The Eighth Night. Which is on Netflix, so you can see it there. And this is this looks to be a South Korean movie directed by Kim Tae-hyung. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, so please forgive me. And I don't know anything about it, but it looks pretty tight. And I'm a big fan of a lot of films, a lot of horror from that part of the world, so I'm excited to see that.
This will be our first Korean film, I believe, that we've covered. I think so.
Yeah.
All right, The Eighth Night. Go to Netflix, check it out. We'll meet back here next week if you dare. Thank you, Tony.
You're welcome, Slap Happy Maddie.
Yo! We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galvins Jr. You can find him on Instagram at Kid Riga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Hey, everyone, want to see a movie? All I even needed is
something like this. An extra pounding.